this point, I think I'll go home and crawl under the bed. Except there are monsters under the bed, so that's probably not a good idea. Our next speaker is Susan Fletcher, Hell and High Water, Natural Disasters at Glen Eyrie. Susan is the historian and archivist for the Navigators, where she documents and interprets the history of Glen Eyrie. She's a native of Colorado Springs, and her experience as a docent at the McAllister House Museum and an intern at the Western Museum of Mining and Industry during her summers home from college convinced her to pursue history,
yes,
as a full-time career. Susan received her MA in public history from Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis, and served as the archivist for Lee University before moving back home to the Springs. She currently serves on the Colorado Springs Historic Preservation Board and is a featured speaker on local history throughout the Pikes Peak region. She is the co-author of the book Dawson Trotman and In His Own Words, and has written several articles for journals and reference works. Susan.
How many of you had flooded basements on Wednesday night? A show of hands? My dad did. He called me on the phone and was telling me he was bailing water. How many of you saw the funnel cloud on Wednesday night? Was I the only one? There was a funnel cloud on Wednesday and we watched it. Well, if you're tired of bad weather, I have a place for us to go. This is, let's go back to the year 1917, 1916. I have an advertisement for the Glen Eyrie Villas. There's a syndicate that's decided to divide up Glen Eyrie and sell villas. This is their advertisement. They are talking about the water system, and they say the water is gathered high up in the mountains where it is free from contamination, well, that's good, and conveyed by conduits to large reservoirs whose capacity is such that there will never be such a thing as scarcity of water for the Glen Eyrie property. Well, that's a good thing, too. The water is so regulated and controlled under this exceptional system that it can be supplied when needed, and the danger from wash and floods is entirely eliminated. The danger from wash and floods is entirely eliminated? Well, sign me up right now. Oh, well, that picture up there, that's a little bit worrisome. That looks like a flood to me. Maybe we should investigate the situation a little more before investing our money. Now, this is a topographical map of present-day Glen Eyrie. Glen Eyrie is down here, and what is it surrounded by? It's surrounded by National Forest, and also there's a creek that runs through the property known as Camp Creek. Now, most of the year, this creek is dry, just like we learned about the Auraria Creek. Dry creek, man, not much to worry about. The creek runs along a path right there to Palmer Reservoir number 5. The Navigators currently own this and operated it as a camp, and that's going to come into play a little bit later on. So this is the property. Now, does it look like there might be a couple things to be worried about here? Maybe potential forest fires or potential floods? Well, we're going to explore some of the disasters that have happened at Glen Eyrie over the years. Now, as Dr. Olson was talking about earlier, we have a combination of two different types of disasters, both man-made and natural. And we're going to explore how the owners of Glen Eyrie have tried to harness the natural resources available to them on the property and how those natural resources have broken through some of those controls at times. So let's talk about the chain of ownership. Now, most of you probably know Glen Eyrie as either the home of Colorado Springs founder William Jackson Palmer or as the current operation base for the Navigators. Now, there's an interesting period that I like to call the intertestamental period here that comes into play. So General Palmer owns Glen Eyrie from 1871 to 1909. He built his beautiful castle. He built a number of outbuildings, barns, a carriage house. He had a huge operation there, gardens, lily ponds, all kinds of things. He also had an extensive water system, and we'll talk about that more a little bit later. After he died, his daughters tried to sell the property, and finally in 1916, a syndicate from Oklahoma, calling themselves the Glen Eyrie Companies, bought the property, and they wanted to divide it up and sell it. And this is the cover of that brochure I was just reading you. Their plan failed, and in 1918, Alexander Cochrane, who was one of the wealthiest bachelors in America, decided to buy the property. He got married in 1920 and got divorced in 1922, and he just didn't spend a whole lot of time on the Glen. He was there occasionally. His sister lived there for a while, but for the most part, he was an absentee landlord, and when you own a house and you're not there very often, that's kind of a recipe for a lot of things to go on. That you won't be able to prevent. Finally, in 1938, the Strake family bought the property. They were oil people from Texas, and they wanted to use Glenary as a summer home. Now, the estate had gone neglected for a number of years after Cochrane had died and his holding company had it. So the Strakes invested quite a lot of money in the property, bringing it up to speed, and they also invested in the water system. In 1953, the Navigators purchased the property, and they are the current owners. Now, that national forest, that is a recipe for a forest fire to happen. And the first record we have of that is under Alexander Cochrane's absentee landlordism. On the 11th of May, Glenary workmen set fire to a pile of trash. And the flames carried one of the burning embers high up into Queens Canyon. The fire spread very quickly and got out of control. J.H. Patterson, the chief forest ranger of the region, and his crew responded to the fire. Now, Glenary is not particularly close to the center of town, so they had to round up as many people as they could to help fight this fire, including the experienced 20 Boy Scouts and a team of students from the Cheyenne School. Now, this makeshift fire brigade fought the flames, and they were able to save the castle, which apparently had been endangered. But the next morning, the supervisor of the Pike National Forest reported that the fire is now in an almost inaccessible place high up on the rocks. He cautioned, "A fire of that character is liable to break out in another spot 2 weeks from now. The fire creeps up under the rocks where it may not be noticed at that time, and at that time when a wind comes up, the danger is renewed." Well, fortunately, the fire burned itself out and didn't cause any further damage. This is an aerial shot of Glenary, and as you can see, Glenary Castle is surrounded by some hills and some forest here. The next indication that we have of a wildfire occurred on April 29, 1992. On the day of the Rodney King verdict, an arsonist drove up Rampart Range Road and set a series of six small fires, perhaps in reaction to the verdict. Some of these fires joined together, and they became quite the conflagration. The fire burned down the hills towards Glenary, and the Glenary headquarters building sent out emergency prayer requests. Eight local fire departments responded to the blaze. They fought 40-mile-per-hour winds, and they finally contained the fire about 3 p.m. that day. Now, Camp Creek actually has been causing more problems than the National Forest and the forest that surrounds Glenary. How many of you have a creek that runs through your property? Do you ever experience your creek flooding by chance? Well, that's probably a good thing to me about it. Yeah. Well, when General Palmer bought or purchased the land that would eventually become Glenary, he decided to take advantage of the water that flowed through his property. Water rights are a really big deal, and if you can harness the water, you have a lot of money and a lot of power in the West. So he made a very extensive water system, and in 1898, he hired engineer Herbert Reed to upgrade the system. According to Herbert Reed, the watershed at Camp Creek covered 9.6 square miles with an estimated runoff of 543 million gallons per year. So that's nothing to sneeze at. By the time of Palmer's death, the water supplied over 56 million cubic feet of water per year, sending water to six reservoirs, including two on the mesa, one of which is still visible today, and one high up in the mountains, and that's the Eagle Lake that I was showing you. Now, The first flood that we have recorded came in 1921, the same system of storms that caused the Pueblo flood of June 4th, 1921, and that would eventually kill upwards of 1,500 people, also hit Glenary. The storm swept away the trail that General Palmer had built in Queens Canyon and demolished the pond at the intake dam. Then a few years later, the Memorial Day flood of 1935 finished everything else off. And I think you guys are going to learn more about both of those floods, especially the Memorial Day flood and some of our upcoming speakers. A few years after that particular flood, George Strait purchased Glenary in 1938 and began the process of rebuilding the water and the trail systems. Strait poured quite a bit of money into this project. When suddenly, on April 10th, 1947, we have this report from Bob Parvin, who is one of his groundskeepers. He says, at or about 7 o'clock p.m. on the evening of May 10th, 1947, without any practically forewarning, a flood of water came roaring down Queens Canyon, which I later learned was caused by a cloudburst high up in the mountains where the canyon heads, resulting in the damage of the Camp Creek Reservoir and the spillway at the head of Queens Canyon, carrying down the canyon for more or less 9 miles. Rubble, trees, logs, boulders, gravel, and rubbish, some of which was strewn throughout that distance. Now, this flood that Parvin had attributed to a cloudburst in the mountains was exacerbated by a failure of Eagle Lake Dam. One of the pipes that ran, that carried water into the dam, had eroded within the dam. And so the dam burst, and it sent upwards of two-thirds of its water thundering down the canyon. And these are some of the results here. At least four of the bridges on the Glen were demolished. You can see right here, this used to be a stone bridge, and the water tore it apart. This is the schoolhouse on the Glenary property, and the creek bed normally runs right about here and is normally dry. As you can see, it's lapping at the sides of it. According to Dan Hampton, most of the beautiful gravel roads were completely washed away, leaving holes as deep as 8 feet throughout the grounds. Trees, logs, and other debris, as well as thousands of tons of boulders, were deposited upon the beautiful reflection lawns and the pools. You can see here one of the fields flooded. Some of the power and telephone lines had been torn down, and the water lines had been ripped up. Bob Parvin estimated that the total loss at Glenary would be upwards of $85,000. Dan Hampton of the Colorado Investment Company estimated that the true value of the entire Glenary estate was $485,000 before the flood. Post-diluvian, however, with the damaged condition of the dams, pipelines, roads, valves, etc., there could be no traffic through the property, nor water supply, nor is tenancy of the buildings possible, which thereby reduced the worth of the property to only a salvage valuation until repairs were made. And Hampton estimated that this value was only $100,000. He told Strake, I am absolutely convinced that no prospective buyer could have been induced to become interested in the purchase of the property. Now, over the next few years, Strake's crews worked to correct the situation. They did quite a bit of cleanup. They especially had a lot of cleanup to do in Queens Canyon. This is a picture of the catwalk system that runs throughout the first maybe quarter mile of the canyon. You can see it, the flood snapped it straight in two. They also had quite a bit of logs and other debris, and according to Parvin, the crew needed to haul away thousands of tons of boulders. Parvin said, the bringing of debris, logs, etc. down Queens Canyon must be burned laboriously by human labor. So that sounds like a lot of work. Now, by the time that Strake had invested already quite a bit of money in this, he held on to the property for a number of years, but it just never really got back to the same shape. And by 1953, his kids were grown, and he no longer needed a summer home for his family, so he decided to sell the property, and that's when the Navigators bought it. Now, when the Navigators purchased Glenary, they inherited all of the water rights and all of the potential threats that Camp Creek would pose. They experienced their first flood in 1965 when an unusually strong system of storms caused by a cutoff low came. Were any of you around for the super storms of 1965? Apparently, they cause widespread tornadoes and hail damage and flood all the way from the Wyoming border through New Mexico. This flooded the creek again. There was silt and debris all across the lawns. John Crawford, who was the director of Glen Eyrie at the time, took the opportunity to strengthen the stone bridges, which is a good thing. Let's see. I think I have time to talk about some of our hikers in Queens Canyon. Now, so far, none of these floods have actually threatened any human lives, but that all changed in 1998. As I mentioned, the navigators currently own and operate a camp up at Eagle Lake, and it was tradition for the campers to hike down the approximately 13 miles from the lake down to Glen Eyrie, sometimes during the summer. One weekend, my friend Jenny, who is currently on staff at the NAVS, was a camper, and she told me her story. The campers were hiking down the canyon when all of a sudden, out of nowhere, a storm arose. And apparently it was a beautiful sunny day and the weather changed just like that. The rain started to fall, thunder and lightning flashed, and the creek rose faster than anyone could imagine it would. The trail was swept away and the hikers were stranded in the canyon. We have stories of hikers climbing up the sides of the canyons to get away from the water. Counselors were laying crossing logs across the creek to try to get everyone out. Fortunately, there were only two injuries. Someone's shoulder was smashed, and someone else broke an elbow in a rock slide, but everyone got out safely. Now, less than a year later, another flash flood would hit, and this time it would threaten to destroy quite a bit more of Glen Eyrie. This is a current picture, a current map of Glen Eyrie. And as you can see, this is the course that Camp Creek takes. And this is normally a dry creek bed. There's normally no water here. During the flood of 1999, this is the part that flooded. This is a picture of the dry creek bed, so you believe me. This is, if you go to the Glen today, this is what you will see. There's no water. Apparently, the spring of 1999 was one of the wettest on record for the region. From April 29th to May 5th, an unusually long period of heavy rain fell upon the region, caused by a cutoff low pressure area that pumped moisture from the Gulf of Mexico against the Rocky Mountains. From April 29th to April 30th, an unprecedented 14 inches of rain fell on Glen Eyrie and 52 inches of snow fell on Eagle Lake above the canyon at the rate of 6 inches per hour. The sudden arrival of such heavy precipitation sent Camp Creek thundering down the canyon once again. There are some pictures here. The Glen suddenly flooded, and there was a conference going on at the time, and they had to evacuate the guests. This is a picture of the staff evacuating guests, very dramatic, in their flatbed truck. And we have some film footage, so I'm going to narrate and tell you more about the flood while this is going on. Oh, okay. I'm not sure why it's not playing. So I'll just show you my pictures. They issued a call for sandbaggers. I'll just fast forward here. They issued a call for sandbaggers because of this situation right here. The bungalow, which is a small building on the property at this location, was threatened by water, as you can see. And so the staff of Glen Eyrie issued a call for sandbaggers, and office workers from the nearby headquarters building, everyone from secretaries to the vice president, donned rain suits and went over and helped sandbag. Prior to this event, crews happened to be in the last phase of a sewer replacement project, so heavy equipment that would not normally be present on the grounds was available for flood relief. Facilities employees Mark Lindbergh and Dick Dodge commandeered the construction vehicles, and they drove a front-end loader and a bulldozer into the creek to try to dig out the creek bottom. And it worked. They were afraid that the bridges would be destroyed once again. And so by digging out the bottoms of the creek, they were able to prevent logs and rocks from jamming things up and destroying things again. The vice president of the Navigators, Lauren Libby, later wrote, "As I donned a yellow rain suit and slashed through knee-deep waters, my heart sank as I witnessed the destruction. Trees uprooted, huge gouges out of the lawn, brush and boulders. Plastered against the bridges, overrun with water, our peaceful valley looked war-torn. He later wrote in a fundraising letter, "Insurance? Yes, we have it, but it appears it will only cover the damage to the buildings. The more substantial damage to the roads, the lawn, trees, shrubs, creek bed, the sewer construction site, well, the insurance adjuster just shakes his head. No coverage." The Navigator's emergency fundraising effort after the flood resulted in the biggest outpouring of donations in the organization's history, approximately $600,000. The cleanup effort took quite a while. Some of our facilities team climbed into the dam and the mud line that had gotten jammed up in the creek and cleaned that out by hand. The director of Glen Eyrie, Kevin DeFelice, later recalled about the flood. "It rallied everyone together. It gave people a chance to say that the Glen was important to us and we're going to save it." Well, the Glen is indeed an important place from a historical standpoint, one of the city's most important historic sites. And the fire department recognized that. In 2004, the fire department and some other organizations joined together to give the Navigators a $4,000 grant for a fire mitigation project. In terms of protecting Glen Eyrie for the future, there are several things that owners, be it the Navigators or future owners, can do. Everything from clearing unnecessary brush and shrubs away from the castle to doing more construction on the creek. So that is the stories, natural disasters at Glen Eyrie.
Our last speaker for this session is John Putnam. Turns out he's a man who knows insurance. He's worked for 43 years in the property and casualty insurance business. During this career, he served as claims representative, systems procedures and analyst, property and casualty producer, client executive, and agency officer. In addition, he also taught a wide range of insurance courses. John received his BA from the University of Massachusetts and an MA from the University of Colorado. As noted above, he attained the CPCU and ARM professional designations, which focus on insurance and risk management. John has served two terms as president of the Professional Independent Insurance Agents of Colorado and has represented this organization as a national director for 6 years. In these roles, he has written many articles addressing insurance issues. He is also an avid reader of American history and considers genealogy family history as his major hobby. Currently, he serves as president of the Pikes Peak Genealogical Society and has contributed several articles to their newsletter. He's married, has two sons and four grandsons, and he's going to speak to us on Pikes Peak Regional Historic Floods, recovering and learning from natural disasters.
I guess it's good afternoon. It's really great to be here, and I must say that the preceding speakers have really set me up pretty well, besides the fact that the weather did as well earlier this week. So I've got a lot to cover. I'm not going to go through a lot of stories, at least initially, but other than to tell you that the theme of arriving from the East, which is my story, in 1970 I came and I got an apartment with my wife in Cragmore, right beside the Templeton Gap floodway. And I was astounded. How can you have a floodway with no water in it? Well, this was in January of 1970, and by July of 1970, we had the Templeton Gap floodway full of water. I've wondered all this time why we had the floodway, why it was necessary to have the floodway, and as part of my talk, we will explore that in more detail. We all know the horrors of floods. We see it on TV all the time, whether it's in the Pikes Peak region or in other areas of the country. It's a fact of life, and it's made more difficult, as you've just heard. Insurance? What insurance? Usually flood insurance is not covered in your regular homeowner's policies, so if you want to have protection from flood, you need to buy a separate flood insurance policy from the federal government, largely, and it's very expensive. So my background in risk management and insurance, besides selling you policies, We like to try to find out why things happen and what we can do to prevent things in the future. We've also, because I'm a history nut and a genealogical nut, try to put those things together, because even though these are nice stories that have impacts, you'd like to think that we as human beings could be learning from these situations so that we didn't have them continually happening. So our area, as you've just heard, has an interesting phenomenon. It's called flash flooding. And whether it's at Glen Eyrie or whether it's the various floods that we'll talk about today, we have a flash flood situation here in this Front Range of the Rockies that most of us have hopefully not experienced, but you will see it in the papers from time to time, the Great Thompson Flood. We've had a series of these, and the question is, what do you do about them? And science is just beginning to learn a lot more about flash floods. It's beyond the scope of my time or knowledge to go into that, but suffice it to say, what I want to do is contrast floods in the kinds that we are normally used to, lots of water going down a river versus the Glen Eyrie hike where all of a sudden there's all this massive water, and that's what we mean by a flash flood. Now I'm going to stay away from the major floods in this basin because we'll hear more about that later, but suffice it to say, historically there have been a series of major floods, basically three of them, the 1935, the 65, you've already heard about both of those, and the 99 floods, which have a bearing on the whole area, and most of those floods deal primarily with the major waterway in this area, which is the Fountain Monument Creek area. However, what I'm going to look at is a more hidden flood history, and it's the flood history of the Shook's Run. Now, for those of you, I'll show you in a few minutes where Shook's Run is, but the Templeton Gap floodway basically is at the headwaters of the Shook's Run, or was. And so we're going to talk a little bit about that, and the remediation to prevent future flooding was the Shook's, the Templeton Gap floodway project that happened in the 50s. Actually the late 40s. And then we'll just briefly review of what we do from here as a city sitting under these beautiful mountains subject to flash flooding. So just to orient you just briefly, we sit at the top of the Fountain Creek Monument watershed, which is part of the Arkansas River watershed. And as you can see from this, it's a kind of like a funnel-shaped place, and you can probably pick up where you pick where you live. But in the city of Colorado Springs, we have the Monument Creek, which we see from the I-25. We all know where Fountain Creek is. But right to the next watershed over is the Shook's Run watershed. And it basically kind of, I can't quite see, I believe it kind of goes in this general area. As a matter of fact, you are sitting in the original Shook's Run area because this is the high water of the Templeton Gap Basin, which we'll talk about in the next slide. So taking a look, we've got several maps here. Taking a look at the historical maps of this particular area, we have Shook's Run, and basically Shook's Run runs from the Templeton Gap Basin up here all the way down through the gap, down along where it kind of flows now, and then it jumps. It doesn't jump, it does now, but it originally kept going, and it joined the Shook's Run down by where Patty Jewett is. And then from Patty Jewett down to Fountain Creek is where the rest of the waterway existed. Now, look at that map. This is in 1909, which is relatively modern by some of the two of the floods, which we'll talk about. But basically, that area up there was nothing except for the Templeton Gap Basin had 12 farms in there, ranches. The area between the gap and down to Patty Jewett was largely open until about the turn of the century, a little towards the end of the 19th century, when we had the development of the Craigmore Mines and also the Craigmore Sanitarium, where UCCS basically exists today. But what I'm trying to suggest to you is not a lot of people, not a lot of houses in the way, or anything of that sort. So then we're going to fast forward to take a look at the same watershed in 1951 after the Templeton Gap floodway had been made. And what do we see? The slow expansion of the city of Colorado Springs. And that expansion, basically what that expansion did was started building in harm's way. And the other thing that all this expansion does is, guess what? When you build houses with roofs and you build streets with asphalt, what happens when it rains? Whoosh, down the watershed. So that puts more pressure on the watershed as we now know it. Now, through the library's services, I was able to find this aerial photograph from 1953, which is just after the construction of the floodway. But what I want to show you, which I find just absolutely amazing because I didn't realize it was quite this recent in history, this is the Templeton Gap. Whoops. This is the Templeton Gap right here. This is where Garden Ranch is in here. The area that we're looking at was just nothing but dry gulches and rangeland in 1953. Oh, one other feature that you might want to see here, I believe this is the CCC camp, the Civilian Conservation Corps camp, that was still standing at that point in time. Now, the point that I want to show you here is two. First, look at the basin, high, dry, not a lot of vegetation on that plain. The second thing I want to show you is look at Austin Bluffs hanging around there, which are high bluffs overlooking that particular area, that when rain falls upon those bluffs, there's 400 feet of elevation drop essentially between their top and the bottom of this basin, and you can imagine there could be a fair amount of runoff from those floods. So moving right along. By 1967, this is 3 years before I arrive, this is the same picture of the Templeton Gap area. And what do we have? Right at the gap, we have the first start of construction, and we're building it in an area that historically has had major floods. Now, I don't know about you, I mean, we all are proud of our ancestry and our great intellectual capabilities, but we've heard before on many instances about, oh, this area will never flood, or it will never flood again, or we're ready for it. In fact, how many times did we hear on the news, we thought the storm sewer system was going to keep up with the rain the other night? Well, guess what? It didn't. And so now here we are with a problem after the fact of having to cope with the all this construction and development that's gone on in an area that probably shouldn't have been developed. So this slide is designed to show you two or three items that I want to just kind of highlight before we go into the actual flood events. And it's pretty well documented that there's a whole bunch of different things that cause floods. But some things make floods worse. So the first one we'll talk about is topography. Well, the topography of this area I've kind of just told you about. For some reason, the natural features surrounding the Templeton Gap Basin, and to a certain degree is a feature along the eastern part of Colorado Springs, certainly defines the northeastern part of the city, is a small mini mountain range. And as such, not only does it have the ability to drop a lot of water over a lot of area where there's nothing to stop it except for trees, except we got another problem on the trees and the bluffs. They're made out of clay. Well, guess what happens when clay gets wet? It just forms a nice little top surface and all the water runs. And that's exactly what's happened in the floods that we'll talk about. Vegetation, why is vegetation important? There's some documentation to suggest that when you have trees that can break the fall of the water, that the runoff is a little slower. Well, if you don't have trees and you don't have a lot of grass, then guess what? Water runs. So that's the vegetation, the land use. There's some evidence to suggest in the Templeton Gap floodway, or in the Templeton Gap Basin, that there was some overgrazing by the ranchers. Big surprise. I mean, when times get tough, and maybe in the early, in some of these events, it was close to some of the natural droughts, but when those occurred, and you have that kind of eats off the vegetation, and you have animals that pack down the top of the dirt, you have another kind of a flood incident. And then the fascinating thing that I discovered, and I will bring it forward to this week's storms, I think there's a very strong possibility that we have a microclimate event structure with those Austin Bluffs Parkway, or with those Austin Bluffs. And here's what happens, apparently. For some reason, the natural phenomenon of the height of those things and the rising warm air and the channeling of all the air currents that come into that area form the, I hate to use the term perfect storm, but that's kind of what we're talking about. And so when those rain events develop over there, watch out. And if you noticed on Wednesday night, the storm came up from the southwest and wrapped around kind of the southern part of Austin Bluffs and whacked the Citadel area. On the next night, they came down from the northeast, backed up against the Austin Bluffs, and very often they sit here for a while and just plain dump. All right, so let's just briefly review a series of floods. Most of these are hidden in time. We all know that floods don't matter unless A, people are killed, or there's lots of property damage. Well, fortunately, we have a death in the, I shouldn't say fortunately, that's an insurance slip. But one of the reasons why the flood of 1885 is probably remembered is because we have our first fatality on the Shooks Run watershed. And basically the facts of this storm are just daunting. And when you look at the first figure that they had 16 inches of rain in 3 to 4 hours. Now let's contrast that with the other night. As far as I know, we may not even have had 2 inches of rain in an hour. So multiply that times 8, and this is the kind of storm that you have. Supposedly, after about three hours of rain, there was some sort of probably a stock pond up in the Templeton Gap Basin that let loose. And that started the whole process of a wall of water that headed down into northeast Colorado Springs. And basically, Bap Eaton, who was the superintendent of schools here in Colorado Springs, and his wife lived right on the northeast edge of Colorado Springs in 1885, which is basically at the corner of Wasatch and Yampa. And they basically settled in for a long winter's nap, or this was spring, it was in July. They settled in for a nap, and lo and behold, at 10 o'clock, they heard this strange sound. So they opened their curtains and looked out, and what do their amazing eyes do they see is a wall of water that was taking out their chicken coop and heading straight for their house. Well, I picture that they didn't have a lot of clothing on at that point in time, so Bap gets quickly into his clothes. The house is taken off its foundation and starts heading down Shooks Run. So there's a decision to be made. What do we do? Bap jumps, his wife stays with the house, and lo and behold, Bap struggles to get his footing, is saved by Melton Sinton, who the founder of the local Sinton Dairy, and he's pulled out of the water as he watches his wife merrily floating down, not merrily, floating down the Shooks Run. At which point in time the house came up against the Bijou Bridge, was dashed to smithereens. It's assumed that she was thrown out of the house at that point in time. She drowned. Her body was found 2 weeks later. So we have a death. We have some damage. The damage to all the farmers and all the people along the way, gardens and everything were damaged. Next flood followed a pretty similar pattern a year later. The only thing, there was no life lost, but there was considerable property damage. And again, same scenario, but probably not quite as much water. The 1922 flood. We'll talk about this in a little more detail because it's probably the more highly documented flood. And we had 7 inches of water in 3 hours, so that's about 4 times more than the storms on the other night. And what happened with this? Well, we also had the wall of water, and the wall of water did 2 things to us. The first thing it did is it flooded Papetown, whichever you wish to use, which is basically at the corner of Fillmore and Hancock, 4 to 5 feet of water. And then, oh, by the way, it continued down to the Rock Island Railroad, which basically kind of follows where Constitution goes across the northern part of the town. And it took out the trestle down there. And then it was then funneled. Actually, it went two ways. 75% of the water went down to Monument Creek following a kind of a natural depression down towards Monument Creek, and the rest of it went down Shook's Run. A lot of damage, and basically the result of that was, hey, we need a dike or a levee up here so that we don't suffer that again. And then in 1932, just 10 years later, we have the same scenario play out. But by this time, we have an interesting issue because in 1927, they'd put up a dike or a dam at the head of, right at the gap, and that thing failed. And when that thing failed, it sent down water again into Pape Town. And who did it damage? It damaged the house of Nicholas Venetucci, who was the father of Tony Venetucci, who we know as the pumpkin guy. Basically, his house was taken, they had two houses in the area that I just talked about where Ted's bicycle shop is today, and basically they were taken off their foundation. Suffered $144,800 damage. And oh, lo and behold, what did the Venetuccis do? They sued the city of Colorado Springs for damages because they said that that damaged their house, or that the existence of the dam existed their damaged their house. So what do we do about flood control? Just quickly, here's a quick scenario of some of the things that happen. We try to do things on the inexpensive side. I was going to say cheap, but the inexpensive. We start with curb and guttering. We do some storm sewers. We develop channels that could channel the water both ways. And then lastly, the first step was to go to the 1927 diversion dam right at the head of the gap. And then we tried in the 30s to use soil conservation techniques as a way to slow down the water and to create some small little check dams and to some diversion ponds, which would hopefully slow the water. And this picture, if you could see it a little bit more, shows some of the contour farming, but I don't think you'll be able to see that. And then the last thing that was finished as part of that was the floodway, which started in 1948 and was finished in 1949. And what has the floodway done for us? Well, the good news is the floodway for 60 years has been I call it a sentinel of power on the northeast part of the Springs. It's prevented any major flooding from ever occurring again. That said, it's a levee. And we all knew what happened in New Orleans to levees. So the federal government has now said, hey, we got to look at these levees. And so as part of the 10-year campaign to look at the levees, guess what? Templeton Gap does not meet the current requirements for a strong levee. So there's great concern about its future. It was supposed to have been remediated, but wasn't able to be remediated because there's no money. So who knows what is going to happen in the future, but it is probably a disaster waiting to happen. So just a couple last comments. First comment. How probable are future floods? Guaranteed. They will happen. Flash floods. The good news is we're learning more scientifically. The bad news is we don't control nature. Who pays? That's the biggest question. Nobody wants to pay. We love living here and so forth and so on, but at the end of the day, boy, we hate paying insurance and we hate paying taxes to pay for it. So I don't really have a good answer for you, except to say we can either be proactive, or if we have the major one, we'll have to react. And my brother used this term on me, so I have to give him credence for this. Are we living in a delusional world of policymaking relative to local flood control? Thank you.